The connections are extraordinary. And so is this year's remarkable Bragg winner. For the second year in a row, it's none other than Caridwyn Dovey, last year's winner, a writer of great distinction and learning. Congratulations, the second time you've won the Bragg Prize. Marvellous. Well done.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Tell me, first question about your topics, because last year, discussing dust on the moon, Brian O'Brien from Western Australia and his ideas that it was all intrusive and a bit dodgy, and this time looking at the sky. Why this emphasis on astronomy and the heavens?
Well, for a few years now, since 2017, when I first met Alice Gorman, who's a pioneering space archaeologist, I wrote a profile of her for The New Yorker and had never really been interested in space or space science as a social scientist. That wasn't really within my field of expertise, but there was something about the way that she spoke about space as a cultural landscape that was like a eureka moment for me. And I was immediately interested in what it might look like to apply some of the thinking of social science to these harder science topics, and to also extend the idea of ethics, and particularly environmental ethics, into outer space, because it's such an interesting time that we're living through where we've seen space be privatized and commercialized. And I just felt increasingly unsettled by the mainstream media coverage of all of these billionaires and the things that they were beginning to do in space, and the ways in which money is starting to be made in what is a global commons of humanity. And it was just that feeling, you know, when something doesn't sit right and when you're not seeing the critical writing about something. And so I began to do that kind of writing, really trying to look at the idea of what are we doing in outer space, who has the right to do it, and then more deeply to look at some of the ethical issues around social and environmental justice, which up to this point have generally been left out of any of that thinking. It's always about the gee whiz excitement over the technological innovation.
Stuff. Alpha men.
Exactly, right? And a lot of old thinking around space as a very masculine kind of macho endeavor. And so I'm really interested in seeing if we can begin to take some of the wisdom of what we've learned about Earth and the mistakes we've made, particularly in how we have thought about Earth's environments, and try and extend that to outer space before we stuff it up. You know, it's kind of like we have a chance to do it right out there, and to not just think of the moon as another wasteland that we can dig up and mine, and to not think of the orbits around our Earth as just space that's ripe for the taking, that can just be stuffed, that space is unpollutable. And I think that's the big shift that I'm asking people to make in the writing I've been doing over the past few years, is to say, 70 years ago, this is how we thought of the oceans. And it took people like Rachel Carson to disabuse us of that notion. And I think we're in the same kind of moment with space. We're on the cusp of either giving full keys to the cosmos to the private industry and taking our eyes off of anything they're doing there.
Yes, it just happens to be the 60th anniversary of Silent Spring, the famous book she wrote 60 years ago. And Alice Gorman, as you mentioned, is not only a space archaeologist, but she's also a winner of the Bragg Prize, just like you, and in the book this year alongside. Now, you're also famous for writing fiction novels, and that's a matter of understanding emotion. And I applaud this very much. How much do you think it's against the grain for scientists to have an emotional content to the discussion of their subject? Have you found that some of the scientists you talk to are a bit hesitant about that?
Generally, no. I think that is changing. And I think thanks to a lot of the great work that anthropologists of science have done and the studies of science and technology from a social science perspective, you know, so much of that interesting work has been about showing that the hard sciences are just as human as anything else that we do, and that questions that are framed as only being technological or scientific in nature, that's never the whole story, that there's a kind of human element to any of the work that is done in the world. So maybe I'm just picking the people who I know can already speak so eloquently about how science is done, peeking behind that curtain and looking at how it's done. But I think with this piece that's about the satellite mega constellations that companies like SpaceX and Amazon and OneWeb are beginning to stuff into orbit around Earth. It was about looking at astronomers who have had to pivot from being fairly passive in terms of how they think of themselves and of their science as being sequestered away and just doing the science head down, you know, and having to really actually become activists to fight to protect their own ground-based right to look into deep time, which is something that, of course, these tech billionaires talk about all the time as something that they support. And so I was really trying to understand what is it that a band of astronomers who across the world have said, not on my watch, we will not let this happen. And it's really interesting because so many of them, yes, they speak about the impacts to ground-based optical and radio astronomy, but they also, many of them, are making those connections across to less tangible human rights, like the human right to dark and radio quiet skies, the human right to visible starlight, acknowledging the incredible cultural heritage for all cultures that is in the night sky. And so I found this group of astronomers that I was speaking to are already thinking in very sophisticated ways about emotion and science and value and what things we do value in the night sky, and really moving outside of that idea of only things with scientific value as opposed to cultural or historical value are worth protecting.
Tell me about the time you looked up at the sky and you saw lights there and wondered whether many of them, or most of them perhaps, were human-made.
Well, there wasn't a sort of moment like that for me. And I say this because I have stumbled into becoming a science writer, but I don't have a hard science training. And I'm very much an outsider and a non-expert, particularly when it comes to space. And so my real passion is to try and understand these things from the bottom up, which is often very, very hard for me, actually. And then use that and try and really make it super clear to other non-experts, just general, you know, ordinary citizens about what's going on and what the stakes are, but also to explain the science in a way that is, you know, accessible. And so for me, it wasn't like I have even spent that much time looking up at the night sky. And at the moment, we're not quite there, you know, in terms of the satellite constellations. You might have seen one or two, but we're certainly not at the point that we're expected to be within about 10 years of 60,000 of these satellites being in orbit around Earth. And at that point, I think it will be a very different kettle of fish. And that's sort of the thing that I think most of these astronomers are trying to work against. And it is a race against time to stop that from happening.
Yes, you talked to Fred Watson and Marnie Ogg, who are usually based either in Sydney or Coonabarabran near the Anglo-Australian Telescope. In fact, they used to run it for about 10 years or so. And they have been campaigning about reclaiming the darkness so that we can actually see the sky, which is so beautiful.
Yeah, and it's wonderful that they shared that time and expertise with me. And Marnie's the founder of the Australasian Dark Sky Alliance, and they're doing amazing work. But the story that really intrigued me that they told me about was that they got married in Hawaii about a decade ago. And the story that Fred told was that they got married on the same mount where the Pan-STARRS 1 telescope is. And this is the telescope that's responsible for detecting near-Earth objects, or also known as killer asteroids. So the types of objects that could potentially have a world-threatening impact. And the thing that really, for me, was the moment when I realized I need to write this piece is that it's those kinds of telescopes, our ability to literally see the killer asteroids, that are most negatively impacted by these new commercial satellite mega constellations. So when we have the space billionaires, who I won't name personally, but when we have them saying that they are doing the things they're doing for all humanity as a plan B backup for our planet, I just found it incredible that these same billionaires, it's their satellite constellations that are literally blinding us to the very same objects that could potentially mean we need a plan B. And so it was unscientific thinking, actually, that really bothers me about these companies, because I think a lot of people, the space geeks and the pundits, we all assume, oh, these are big tech companies. They've got the big brains there. They've got the biggest nerds in the business. They are thinking through everything at so many levels. But they aren't. And I think what really became apparent with SpaceX is that before they launched their Starlink mega constellation, before they started to properly launch it in batches in 2019, it had not occurred to them to think about the fact that these objects might be highly reflective and bright and that they would have any impact on astronomy. And they had not consulted with the scientific and astronomy community in terms of the design or any of the impacts before they began to do this. And so again, in terms of answering your question, why did I write this piece? There were these moments where it was just really unpicking some of the illogic behind the thinking of these tech companies that I think generally we give the benefit of the doubt. We think they're going to do it right and that they're really doing their homework. And I was really shocked that they had not, it just had not occurred to them. And so now, of course, they're in a kind of weird race against trying to add these modifications to the satellites like DarkSat and VisorSat, but it's all after the fact. And the astronomers that I spoke to generally have said there probably won't ever be a technical fix that will completely resolve this issue. It's going to be a problem for astronomers on the ground for forever.
Well, I hope what you've written will make a difference, but congratulations doubly. Two in a row. Fantastic. Caridwin.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Yes, Caridwin Dovey, winner of this year's main prize. And you can see the full list on the Science Show website, including the two student runners-up, Elora and Stephanie, who are on the Science Show next week, together with the winner of the Prime Minister's Prize for Science. It's all in the best Australian science writing book published this week by New South Press. And my thanks to their CEO, Kathy Bale. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher, with help from CPE Bach. I'm Robin Williams.